Welcome to All Sides with Anna Staver. From New York to California, pro-Palestinian demonstrations have rocked campuses across the country.
Free Palestine!
Free, free Palestine!
Free, free, free Palestine!
Free, free, free Palestine!
Students and some professors are demanding their schools support a ceasefire in Gaza and divest from companies that profit off this conflict. And the protesters are pitching tents, refusing to leave until their demands are met. Joining me to talk about the Gaza encampment at Ohio State University is WOSU reporter George Shilcock. Welcome back to All Sides, George.
Hey, Anna. Thank you for having me.
And here to talk about what's happening across the country is the Chronicle of Higher Education reporter David Jesse. Welcome to All Sides, David. George, let's start with the three W's. Who, what, and where? So who came out to the protest at Ohio State? What was it like? And where did it take place?
So to start with the who, there were hundreds of protesters there on, it was last Thursday. They were a mix of students, faculty, community members, as we've learned, somewhere in the range of 300 to 600 people. The what is, of course, that they were there to protest half calling, of course, for a ceasefire in Gaza, but also they're calling on Ohio State University to divest and disclose, which basically means to stop funding sources that they perceive to be related to Israel, companies that they believe also work in Israel or work with Israel. And then what was the other one?
Where did it take place?
The South Oval on Ohio State University's campus, which is, of course, like right behind the Ohio Union. You walk out. Big grassy area, not as big as a regular oval, but right
yeah,
there.
Yeah, it's if you're pretty not an iconic place on campus.
Of course.
And after a certain point, campus police told protesters to disperse. What happened when they didn't?
Well, this is a bit complicated. They told them to disperse multiple times. First, it was a 5-minute warning. 5 minutes came and went by hours. Then it was two 15-minute warnings.
Okay.
And again, came and went by hours. It was finally right after dark, just after 10 p.m., where things started getting more tense. They told reporters, hey, move to this side. And we knew something was about to happen.
Oh, yeah. When they put you guys all in one place, it means they're going to move in.
Mm-hmm. Then it turns out they came in from the exact opposite side that they told reporters to stand. Ohio State Highway Patrol was there. OSUPD, the Franklin County Sheriff's Office, showed up with a couple buses labeled sheriff to put people they were going to arrest in. And that's when arrests began. They walled off this protest and they started pulling individuals out, 4 or 5 officers per person, and bringing them to the bus to be arrested.
And about how many students, community members, like how many people were charged as a result of this protest on Thursday?
That night, 36 were arrested, but actually throughout the week there were even more arrests, and it came to 41 total.
And
charged with criminal trespassing, I should say.
So it's basically once Ohio State said, get off my lawn, it was trespassing.
Basically, yes, but they were, of course, allowed on that lawn for a good 5 to 6 hours before that happened.
And I want to say that we invited Ohio State President Ted Carter or any representative of Ohio State University to come and talk with us about what happened on Thursday, and they've all declined. University spokesperson Ben Johnson has been releasing statements on behalf of Ohio State. What have they said?
So the Ohio State University and Ben Johnson, they are basically saying that these protesters were violating what the university calls their space rules. Nothing to do with anything extraterrestrial. It's really just the spaces in the university and what people can do or not do in them. One of the things specifically outlined in this is that they can't camp. And these protesters on Thursday night were setting up encampments. They actually even tried earlier in the morning and were broken up. The other thing that the university says they were violating is that they needed a reservation and that they couldn't be disruptive. It's exam week here at OSU. There are students that were studying and even taking exams in the Ohio Union right next door, of course. But after repeated warnings, these hundreds of protesters didn't break up, and eventually police did move in to pushed them off and cited the space rules as a reason for criminal trespassing.
And this camp rule, that's been a policy at Ohio State for a long time.
We don't exactly know. We know the space rules were last updated in 2021.
So it's been a minute.
Yeah, and a huge update apparently. No specifics were given to us back in 2016, but they've apparently been around for a long time. We just don't know how long exactly as of now.
So, David, I want to bring you in here. Sort of the same kinds of questions, but on a national scale. Do we know how many protests have resulted in arrests like the ones that we saw here in Ohio at universities really across the country?
But it is definitely happening on a regular basis. I think we're probably around a dozen or more campuses where there have been arrests, and there were some reports of them even last night, overnight, that we're still trying to confirm out, particularly in the West Coast.
Yeah, and Columbia University is really where this all started. And just notably, yesterday, I believe, they told their encampment to leave or they would be suspended. And they started suspending students who were still camping.
Yeah, we're seeing a lot of that now. You know, the first wave was arrest. And now we see them going to suspensions, which, you know, for students is a big deal, especially the end of semester coming up. And if you can't finish up, so you're not going to graduate. You're not going to graduate. You're not going to get credit for the whole semester of class that you're taking.
And what has the reaction from university presidents been across the country? Because it seems like it's all over the place.
It is. So you have a whole mix of them. I just wrote a story that published the other day in the Chronicle where I talked to probably half a dozen or more university presidents. And so you see a real mixture. You see those like Ohio State, like Columbia, like University of Texas at Austin, where they're sending in the police right away. I think when we talked to smaller college presidents, I think you're seeing a little bit different approach. You're seeing that they're working with students to let them protest, to let them set up. A couple of presidents said, you know, having a relationship with their students is very key. You're also seeing in some bigger schools some different strategies. For example, at Michigan State, the new president there went out and met with the protesters when they set up, told them that they needed to get a permit, but you know, they fast tracked that permit and gave them the time to be there. And so I think you're seeing a mix of folks trying to work with students who are protesting, trying to understand them a bit. And then on the other side, you have the folks we were talking about at the beginning of this conversation who are just sending in the police right away.
So we've talked about the who, the what, and the where for these protests. Let's move on to that important fourth W, the why. And for that answer, I want to start with Jamil. He's a lead organizer of the protests here at Ohio State.
We're here and we'll be here. We won't stop. We're not going to rest until we get the divestment. That's what we're calling for. We're calling for divestment. We're calling for divestment of the university from the different companies that invest and are a part of this apartheid and a part of this ethnic cleansing. I personally can't go and sleep at night knowing that I am contributing to it, both through my U.S. tax dollars and through my tuition money. It doesn't sit right with me. So I have to do my part as a student of this university to raise my voice and at all costs necessary. If that means get arrested, if that means drop a class or two, if that means being suspended from the university, then so be it. There are some things that are larger than other things. There are causes that are larger than other causes, and there are causes that are worth to fight for, and there are causes that are worth to sacrifice for, and this is a cause that we're willing to sacrifice for.
George, do we know what companies or funds the students want Ohio State to divest from? And are we talking about its endowment, its like retirement funds for its teachers? Like what do they want us to divest from and what companies?
Really depends on who you ask. When I was interviewing Jamil right after the protest was broken up, we were standing right off the South Oval as police were just standing there. Jamil specifically mentioned Hewlett-Packard, which of course makes printers that are probably in a lot of Ohio State University buildings, as he mentioned, and a lot of other computer products. There's a range of different investments that the protesters say the university is making. We've never gotten an exact list of these companies. That's one thing the protesters are calling for, is this disclosement of
They want to see where all the money is being spent.
Yes, exactly.
David, You know, what OSU students are demanding is pretty much what students across the country are asking their universities to do. How complicated of an ask is this? Like, if universities were willing to divest, it's not as simple as, like, calling Hewlett-Packard and being like, hey, we're not buying anymore.
Right, exactly. So it's hugely complex for a number of reasons. One, there's a lot of demands to not invest using endowment funds, which is hard to do because a lot of the endowment funds are invested into either venture capital funds or hedge funds, and it's just hard to track exactly where all that money is ending up, other than, you know, with that particular fund that then invests in a number of companies over a number of different places. So it could be hard to get that money.
So it's like a 401k, right? Like if I'm in the S&P 500, then like my retirement is in a whole bunch of different companies that is managed by the 401k.
Yeah, exactly. And so if you wanted to say, I don't want to invest in anybody, you know, I don't want any of my 401k funds to go into anybody who, you know, invests in Israel or who makes, you know, shampoo that's tested on animals, it can be hard to figure out exactly what companies your money is going into because it all sort of lumps together. And so that's a process. The other thing that's going on is over the course of time when there have been other calls for disinvestment in a number of things, particularly like fossil fuel, universities have changed their investment policies to try to what they claim unpoliticize them. And so there's just a number of hoops that would have to be jumped through to even consider disinvestment. The other thing is, you know, in a number of cases across the nation, it isn't that they are necessarily investing in companies, but it's like the copiers at Ohio State, where they're taking services. So, for example, at Portland State University, students are demanding that the university sever all ties with Boeing. Portland State doesn't invest in Boeing, but Boeing, which is located there, gives money for scholarships. And so, you know, how do they handle that relationship? So between a lot of these companies and the universities, there's some really deep tangled webs that, you know, is not an instantaneous cutoff if they would want to do it.
So later in the show, we're going to talk to two attorneys, but I want to ask you both about the free speech debate that these protests have sparked. And George, you know, Ben Johnson, again, speaking on behalf of OSU President Ted Carter, has talked about this balance between demonstrators who want to exercise their First Amendment rights and what he says is essentially incitements of violence or threats.
Mm-hmm. So one thing that's been pretty consistent across the university statements is them saying, hey, we are full supporters of freedom of speech. But when it comes to like why they're breaking up these protests in the first place, they're really going back to like this whole time, place, manner restrictions placed upon the First Amendment by the U.S. Supreme Court, something they've specified about protests and how they're violating, again, going back to these space rules. They are saying like, hey, if there is hate speech, anti-Semitism, we're not going to tolerate that. We totally condemn that when it happens. But they've not to date cited hate speech or anything like that as a reason for making these arrests and breaking up these protests.
And speaking of those arrests, they were made by Ohio State Police or campus police. Why were Columbus police not involved?
Yeah, so this is something I'm actually reporting on today. Columbus police and OSUPD have been back and forth with me, but we've essentially found out that, yes, Ohio State had this conversation with Columbus police, but then which are essentially their neighbors as a law enforcement entity.
City of Columbus is right here. And sometimes when they need extra help, they come and help.
Mm-hmm. It's mutual aid. But Ohio State Highway Patrol, Franklin County Sheriff, they showed up. Columbus police did not. They chose not to show up despite having this conversation with OSU. We're unsure if there's an actual request made, but they did decline. They've been very adamant, both in a city council meeting last night and to me over email, that the helicopters flying overhead, not Columbus police. Police officers making those arrests, not Columbus police. They were outside the protests, like a block away on High Street, sort of in what they've, what is their territory. It's their jurisdiction. But despite being at past campus protests, they were at one at the Oval back in October, I covered, with their dialogue unit, which are meant to defuse these protests and even rowdy sports crowds. They were not here. They were not here at any of the arrests that were made this week. And they've been telling people that very clearly.
I think it's a really difficult and complicated situation, David. How are, you know, universities across the country handling this question of what law enforcement to call, who should be interacting?
Yeah, I think it depends on the campus, depends on what their relationships are. It depends also on the political structure of the state. That's why you see, like, for example, in Texas, where the governor there has been very very firm and very vocal about, you know, that these protests need to be broken up and that the folks need to be arrested. You know, he's sending in state police, the Texas Rangers. And so I think it depends a lot on who's calling the shots as far as who's showing up to make these arrests.
And there's another protest planned here at Ohio State for Wednesday, May 1st. Is that correct?
Yep. Wednesday, May 1st, 6 p.m. The protesters, the group Students for Justice in Palestine, they're one of the main organizers here. They're saying 6 p.m. at the South Oval again. This is today is the last day exams here on campus. Students are already out doing their bar crawl. But the essentially, that's going to be the next date to watch, and we're going to be there to cover that.
And you can follow George on X, formerly known as Twitter, or WOSU's Instagram account, where he will be giving live updates from the protest tomorrow evening. George, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you, Anna.
And thanks to David Jesse, reporter for the Chronicle of Higher Education.
Thanks for having me on.
Coming up, we're talking with the president of Ottermine about how universities navigate these demonstrations. That's when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to All Sides. I'm your host, Anna Staver. We're talking about how protests in opposition to Israel's war in Gaza have rocked college campuses across our state and across our country. We spent the first part of the show focused on the protesters themselves, what they want, and what's happening to them when they're arrested. Now I want to talk about the colleges and universities. Joining me is John Comerford, president of Otterbein University here in Central Ohio. Welcome back to All Sides.
Thanks, Anna. Glad to be here.
Before I begin, I want to note that we invited Ohio State to participate in today's conversation. Ohio State University, through its spokesman, Ben Johnson, declined to make President Carter or any other university representative available for today's show. Let's talk about endowments, John. Private universities, especially the Ivy League ones, have large multi-billion dollar endowments that get invested in all kinds of things. Everything from real estate to stocks to individual companies. And student protesters across the country are asking their schools to divulge how those endowments are invested and then divest from companies that support Israel. First, how complicated of an ask is that?
Well, I would start by saying that if any of those Ivy League institutions want to trade their billion-dollar endowments for ours, we'll happily take this problem off their hands. But the reality is, as your last guest just said, it is very complicated. If you looked at most university endowments, including Otterbein's, it would be invested in a mix of mutual funds and venture capital funds. And so it is sort of a basket of things that then you'd have to peel back and find out, well, this mutual fund holds stock in these 200 companies, and each one of those companies has a different relationship. And, oh, by the way, it is a global economy. And so trying to find companies that aren't working on a global scale across different industries and different countries and different spaces, I think it would be disappointing for most of the protesters to find out what really this looks like, because it looks like a collection of mutual funds.
Part of the challenge, I think, is how we define support for Israel. So a weapons manufacturer seems pretty clear-cut, but protesters at Columbia have asked to divest from companies like Microsoft because they provide cloud services to Israeli military.
Yeah, and that's where, again, there's no one sitting. I'm not sitting in my office at Otterbein thinking about, well, I should buy Microsoft stock today and I should sell Adobe stock today. That's not how this works. We have investment advisors that tend to use mutual funds. It's also the case, so let's remember the point of the endowment. The point of the endowment is generally to support the institution, and the biggest chunk of endowments is typically for student scholarships. And so maximizing return to meet our mission to serve students who need financial aid support is really the central mission of that endowment. And if you start mixing in other causes with it, you might end up hurting that central mission.
For example, what we talked about earlier with Portland State University, Boeing provides money for scholarships. So divesting from that would mean figuring out another way to pay for those scholarships.
That's right. And that's much easier said than done, of course. It's also the case that I don't think we want to live in a world where, you know, hey, here are the companies that are on my team and those companies are on your team, and seeing the world in this black and white way. The reality is, I would hope our students and our graduates want to work from often inside those companies to make them better if they need to improve, as opposed to simply writing them off. There's a better case for change if you're able to work from the inside out.
Balancing free speech versus the safety of all students on campus feels like a bit of a high wire act right now. And I want to read you a quote from Columbia University professor Mahmoud Madami, which he gave to CNN. And it says, "We teach our students not to accept things at face value. We teach them to ask questions, no matter the consequences. The idea of penalizing students for protests, the administration has turned the site of a protest into a crime scene." What do you make of that?
Well, I make of that, I mean, that is going to be one take. And I'm not able to comment on what's happening at Columbia or Ohio State or anyone else in particular. But typically, my understanding is the consequences that come are not because of protesting. They're because of harassing speech of those walking by, of blocking the operations of the institution, of, you know, trying to occupy buildings that are otherwise needed to operate the place. These sorts of things tend to be problematic. I think most university leaders, and your last guest from the Chronicle referenced this, certainly at a smaller college campus, if it's a protest, it's not disruptive, it's not violent, there's no harassing speech, no one's going to get in the way of that. In fact, we have a policy that would perfectly allow for that. They don't even have to schedule it in advance on our campus, so long as they're part of the internal university community and not from the outside. That's not going to be punished. It's something that's disruptive that gets to be a problem, and you have to draw a line at some point.
Aren't protests, though, designed to be disruptive, to break the norm, get people's attention?
I think they're designed to get people's attention, certainly. But do you have to harass people as they walk by? Do you have to take a stand that is directly inflammatory? I would hope, and this is just my hope, I don't think we always get this right in higher ed, certainly, but I would hope that we're teaching students to be change agents. And change agents aren't bomb throwers, right? The goal is to bring people along to your viewpoint by engaging in dialogue and being open yourself. And even the phrase that sometimes these protesters use about having lists of demands, well, that implies there's no discussion to be had. They're demands. You either meet them, you're either for with us or you're against us. And it's this black and white dualistic worldview that I would hope we could model better on our campuses.
I want to talk a little bit about that harassing speech or the environment created, because universities have to consider how these demonstrations are impacting their Jewish students. I spoke with Jeremy Davis yesterday. He's a senior here at Ohio State and the outgoing president of the Hillel on campus. So I guess I want to just start generally with, what has life on campus been like for the last couple months?
Well, specifically for Jewish students, it's been, you know, very fearful. A lot of students are just very frustrated because they have to deal with just, you know, the ongoing war, and then just a lot of, you know, anti-Semitism in addition to, you know, stress that they already received from their classes. I think a lot of students are just really tired. And quite honestly, I think everyone just wants to go on a vacation.
And we should be clear that, you know, Jewish students aren't a monolith of belief about the Hamas attacks and the war in Gaza, right? Like, there is a multitude of opinions about this reaction.
There's this saying, two Jews, three opinions. So there's a whole spectrum of interpretation, but I will say that the majority mainstream American Jewish view is that, you know, we should support Israel. Maybe we don't like the Israeli government. We don't like Netanyahu, but, you know, we stand with Israel 100%.
What do you make of the protests and the encampments that have bubbled over in the last week?
Yeah, so I know, I mean, certainly something, you know, it came up at Ohio State, but in terms of like the encampment, you know, I think there's an argument to be made that, you know, free expression 100% belongs in a democracy. But, you know, President Carter at Ohio State outlined this in his email today. He said this is not free expression. You know, there are clear rules and regulations, and the First Amendment outlines this in time, place, and manner. You know, just not abiding by the rules, I think we can judge the content of the speech. And some of the speech was very, you know, just blatantly hostile. For example, at Ohio State, chants for Intifada Revolution, chants for From the River to the Sea, which are calls for death and destruction of the Jewish people. I don't know why anyone who's yearning for peace or for, you know, arguing maybe for the war to end, which is there's an argument to be made there, why anyone would be chanting for Intifada when in the 90s, you know, Intifada has resulted in, you know, a death of, you know, many Israelis and Palestinians. Also, they chanted, you know, Zionist off our campus. I think, you know, the vast majority of American Jews are Zionists. They believe in the self-determination of the Jewish people, which is what a Zionist is. And I think we're just very taken aback by the unwelcome nature of some of these protests.
Does it make you uncomfortable to tell people that you're Jewish?
I certainly, look, if I were walking on the street and someone just came up to me and asked me if I'm Jewish, I would probably just, you know, say, you know, why do you ask? I never thought that as an American Jew, I would ever have to hide my Jewishness, but I certainly hid my, I have a little high necklace that I wear, and I wouldn't wear a kippah. Kippah is, you know, the religious.
Yeah, I know what it is.
Skull cap, right? I probably wouldn't wear that in America. Maybe in Crown Heights, but I would never ever wear one. It's a reality I would never have imagined. You know, I can't imagine being a German Jew in the 1920s. You know, being fully integrated into society, owning a business. You know, being a university student like myself, and then, you know, 10 years later, just the worst possible scenario hits. I feel like, you know, perhaps we're undergoing something very similar here in America.
So as a university president, how do you balance all of this? Because I don't think you want students on campus of any faith who are afraid to wear symbols of their beliefs out of fear of harassment.
No, certainly not. And it's hard to hear that he would feel that way. And certainly we ought not to want that. I do think it's an outlying thing, but we've seen some things in the media. I think I saw Columbia, I assume it was a student holding a sign saying something about you're Hamas's next victims. I mean, that is blood-curdling. And so we need to make sure that our campuses are welcoming to people of different viewpoints, different backgrounds, different religions, everything. We need to be a microcosm of society, and we need to respect free speech, but not tolerate hate speech in that environment that makes it so someone doesn't feel like they belong. The reality is otherwise we end up with higher ed looking like a lot of society generally, which is, well, if you're liberal, you go here, and if you're conservative, you go there, and you hang out with your people all day long. And college campuses need to be better than that. This needs to be one of the places where you can go meet people who are different than you, different backgrounds than you, and have respectful, informed, caring conversations. And sometimes you see that value being cut against on campuses today, and that's a shame.
Yeah, we're only a couple of months removed from there were two Ohio State University students walking home. They were asked if they were Jewish. They said yes, they were, and then they were attacked.
Yeah, and that's something that I know the university took seriously, and obviously I'm not directly engaged in any
no.
of that, but any university
but
would.
But it puts everybody on edge.
Well, and we wouldn't want anyone, given their religion or race or sexuality or whatever it is, to be harassed for who they are. And I know we can't, we don't have perfect control of our campuses, right? These campuses are full of thousands of people, and some of them are going to do some things that we are not going to be proud of, but we need to be affirmative and proactive in how we deal with that to make sure that our campuses are as welcoming as we can make them.
Yeah, I was a college student on September 11th, and I can remember how life just fundamentally changed for Muslims or people who just appeared to be potentially from the Middle East following that attack.
Yeah, and how much of that is based on people's assumptions and misinformation? So we have a lot of Muslim students on our campus at Otterbein, a lot of Somali American students that have chosen our campus, which is great. But the amount of misunderstanding about who they are and where they're from and the difference, say, in dress between a student who is wearing Muslim attire versus Sikh attire and these sorts of things, there's a chance for education and betterment, but you have to start with open-mindedness on both sides. And unfortunately, in a campus with thousands of people, you're going to always have a few that aren't there yet, and we need to make sure that they don't taint the campus culture.
I want to talk about some of the consequences. Mm-hmm. So obviously being arrested for trespassing is one kind of consequence, but we just saw at Columbia, they gave the people camping in their area a firm deadline to leave, and those who didn't have now been suspended. And that feels like a very serious consequence for a student.
Yeah, it, certainly being suspended is a big deal. There's no doubt about that.
You might have to repeat the semester. You might not be able to graduate on time.
Yeah, you might change schools entirely at that point if they're going to kick you out for a little while and things like that. So it's a big, big deal. I'm not, of course, familiar with what those students were told and what behavior was being addressed and things like that. The reality is, and I think your previous guest talked about this, that usually there's an opportunity to be able to dialogue with students. And that's the goal, right? The goal in student behavioral issues, even outside of protest, just, you know, you get caught with alcohol and you're not 21 or whatever happens, it's usually education first. How can we help the student learn from this behavior? How can we help them move forward without making that same mistake again? It's, you don't start with something draconian. And so I would hope and assume that students are given those chances to learn and move forward with those new lessons before something draconian happens.
Yeah, in the case of USC, they have canceled their graduation ceremony. Part of the reason Columbia says it is pushing to remove the encampment is that's where they plan to hold graduation. And this is so difficult because kids have worked so hard to get to these moments. And if you do the math, the class of 2024 was the high school graduation class of 2020, which means they may miss both high school and college graduation.
That's right. That is heartbreaking. And I actually saw an interview with a USC student who made that point. They missed their high school graduation. Now they miss their college graduation. And again, you would hope that we could all respect certain rites of passage and not disrupt someone's ability to celebrate their life. This interview I saw was a student who was a first-generation student. First in his family to go to college, went to USC, life-changing stuff. The whole family was going to come. Tickets were bought, hotels were reserved, and then it got canceled. And I think most people would agree that's a real shame that's not going to happen now at USC.
Yeah, I feel really bad for those kids.
Yeah, now I'm thankful. Otterbein graduated on Sunday, and so we did
went
so
off without
successfully
a
without a hitch. Nothing but celebration and tears. It was great.
You know, there's also consequences for university presidents. You know, we're only a couple of months removed from when several presidents of prominent universities were called to Congress to testify about how they were handling rising anti-Semitism on their campuses. And then quite a few of them lost their jobs. So, I mean, you don't want to think it's about job security, but as a university president, I have to imagine, you know, Ohio State, Columbia, USC, they're also thinking about how I handle this and how sort of Congress is going to react to how I handle this.
Yeah. One of my things about this job is I tell people it's like being the lightning rod of the institution. You sit at the top and therefore the lightning strikes hit you first. And it's not
that's a good analogy.
It's not about you personally. Even though it doesn't happen a lot, thankfully, at Otterbein, but I've been called names and been told I'm a bad person and, well, I'm using other language. But you can imagine what I've been told on occasion when someone didn't like a decision that was made. The reality is you're just absorbing that for the institution. I think I do worry about higher education. This is becoming one of those jobs that fewer and fewer people want. They see what you have to go through, and they see the personal nature of the attack sometime. And I've been lucky at Otterbein that hasn't been much of my experience there. But it can really wear someone down. someone who is generally, I think, I don't know all these presidents personally, of course, but I think everyone's doing their best and trying to balance the policies and different priorities and what's good for students and what's good for their campus and trying to find their way through that. And when it's an us versus them, and if you're not on our side, not only do I disagree with you, you're evil. That is hard to live with some days.
That was Otterbein University President John Comerford. Thanks, as always, for your time.
Thanks, Anna.
Coming up, the legal ramifications, both for universities and demonstrators. That's when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to All Sides. I'm your host, Anna Staver. Protests against Israel's war in Gaza have spread across this country, including here at Ohio State, where 19 students have been arrested. Viral videos show law enforcement, often in riot gear, pushing, shoving, and in some cases knocking down protesters as they move in to make arrests. We've been talking about why the students are camping out and how university presidents are thinking about these demonstrations. Now, I want to turn to the legal questions, the First Amendment questions these protests raise. Joining me is Mazen Rasul, a Palestinian-American attorney serving as co-counsel for many of the arrested protesters. Welcome to All Side, Mazen.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
And we're joined by Temple University history professor Ralph Young. Young is an advocate and chronicler of protest movements in America. His new book, American Patriots, A Short History of Dissent, came out in January. Welcome to All Sides, Professor Young.
Well, thank you for inviting me.
Mazen, what charges are the Ohio State students facing from these arrests?
They are all M4, misdemeanor, criminal trespass charges.
And in your opinion, how did police handle these arrests on Thursday night?
I think they handled them in a very wrong way. It was very violent, unnecessary, uncalled for. They started their first threats within less than an hour, really, of the start of the protest. So all of the claims of this overnight event and what the president of OSU is saying, none of it really even holds any validity because the protest was still within the first hour when the first threat came to the students to leave.
There were comments online, and I want you to, I'm hoping you can confirm or contradict them, but there were comments online of police removing hijabs, which are worn by women in observance of their religion. Have you heard any accounts of that happening during these arrests?
I have heard so much. The arrests is one problem, what happened during the arrests process, which was very brutal, but also the treatment of those arrested from the start, about 10 p.m. up until 9 a.m. when they were released was terrible. The hijabs was one of the biggest issues that I personally had. I personally witnessed it. I was at the Oval, and I witnessed them remove hijabs off certain ladies, and we were all shouting at them, put back their hijabs on, put back their head, you know, put a scarf on them, and they were just refusing and not listening.
Professor Young, what do you make of that description of how these arrests went down at Ohio State?
Well, it's a very heavy-handed approach, very much like what's been going on at Columbia University and a number of other universities around the country in which these protests are taking place. And what people, you know, are not thinking clearly enough is that, you know, the more brutal or the more, you know, heavy-handed the attempts to stifle dissenters is only going to increase the protests, not only get more people to join that particular protest, but in other campuses around the country, people are going to join in. And it's not even, it also brings in the matter of free speech. It's the attempt to stifle dissent that just inflames the protesters.
And that's something I wanted to ask you about, Professor Young, is, you know, since you look at protests and like throughout American history, how do we historically balance free speech versus safety versus time, place, and manner? We're hearing that phrase here on Ohio State a lot, that, you know, there's a time, a place, and a manner for conducting a protest.
Well, Martin Luther King addressed that in his letter from Birmingham Jail when he said that, that there is no such thing as you have to wait for the right time to do this, because people who have to figure out the right time to do it are just never going to be able to get their voices heard. And also the thing is that you need to express your point of view. And the protest is essentially disruptive. Henry David Thoreau wrote about this in his essay on civil disobedience, that you need to kind of push the system to listen to you. And the only way to do that in most cases is to be disruptive.
Mazen, what happens next for these students who've been arrested?
Well, our demand has been from the first moment, and I was on the Oval demanding from the police on that spot, is to drop the charges and release those students. And we continue to repeat this demand to drop all the charges. Now, remember, not all of those have the same exact case. We have about 38 from that evening who were arrested, but there were others from the morning. One was actually around noon, was arrested, a professor or a faculty at Ohio State who was also a graduate student. She was not even part of any protest. She was just sitting on the South Oval reading a book, and there's plenty of videos documenting that. She was not part of any encampment or protest or anything. She was sitting on the Oval reading a book. But if I may have 1 second, 1 minute,
oh, yeah,
just to go back before this protest. You know, the main demand of the protest is to divest, disclose and divest, correct? And the Ohio State students tried to pass that through an initiative by the student body. They wanted to have a call for the administration to disclose their investments and divest. And that initiative was taken off the ballot midway through the voting process, which was in itself a violation of their First Amendment rights as students to vote on whatever initiative they want to vote on.
And do you think this student who says, you know, I was just reading a book, I wasn't part of it, or the female students who had their hijabs removed, this may be on the scope of your legal practice, but do you see the potential for a case against Ohio State for how these interactions went down?
Trust me, we don't have enough attorneys to take on these cases. There's so many cases, not just one case. On this, you know, there's so many violations that occurred on the Oval throughout that day and in the evening and in the nighttime while these students and other protesters were arrested. There were so many violations that took place, and we don't even have enough attorneys to cover all of these issues.
Professor Young, I want to ask, what if any parallels can be drawn between the protests that we're seeing today and, say, the campus protests against the war in Iraq 20 years ago, or even going all the way back to the opposition to the Vietnam War?
Well, you know, it's to me, it's almost like deja vu all over again. You know, I'm teaching courses on dissent in America, and we were recently talking about 1968 and all of the various things that were happening then. And the protests against the war just continued to increase over time. The longer it went without the administration or anybody in power to start addressing some of the issues, the more people joined in the protests. And also, I mean, take a look at Chicago in 1968, when people were protesting outside the Democratic Convention. And of course, the Democratic Convention this year is going to be in Chicago again, so there's another little parallel. But the police just went in and brutally began attacking the demonstrators, and as they were shouting, "The whole world is watching! The whole world is watching!" In some ways, heavy-handed tactics to stifle the dissent or to remove protesters actually is almost one of the best things for the protesters. It increases public awareness and increases attention on the whole issue that people are protesting.
And actually, in 2004, the Republican National Convention was held in New York City, and the police there arrested thousands of demonstrators, and ultimately, eventually, I mean, I think it took like a decade, but they ended up paying out millions of dollars for improper arrests for, you know, excessive uses of force. So sometimes, in certain circumstances, you know, it actually results in financial penalties against the entities.
You know, the protesters are being peaceful for the most part. I mean, any of the any really disruptive behavior comes from people who are maybe countering the protesters. And this is something that, you know, when you think of what was happening during the Vietnam War protests, they were much more, you know, aggressive, much more in your face. What I've been seeing and reading in the papers about what's happening in the last couple of weeks, these protesters are very moderate in comparison to the anti-war protesters back in the 60s. And so it's so, you know, really ill-advised on the part of university administrations to, you know, do the kinds of things that they're doing. Like at University of Southern California, they canceled graduation ceremonies because of the protests being disruptive. Well, you know, this is one of the, you know, greatnesses of the United States, is that we have that right to protest. And what they should be doing is holding the graduation ceremonies and acknowledging the protest and saying, you know, this is what makes America great. As Martin Luther King said in his last speech, he said, the greatness of America is the right to protest for right. And universities should listen to that, and they should listen to the protesters.
Mazen, I want to ask about how we balance the rights of all students on campus. So what would you say to Jewish students who have said they felt unsafe or like they had to hide outward signs of their faith to avoid harassment?
Well, first, it's important to remember that the protests all of on Ohio State and on all other campuses included many, many Jewish students. So many Jewish students actually are leading those protests across the country and at Ohio State. That's one important thing to remember. Secondly, we have not seen, yes, we've heard of claims of people, you know, feeling unsafe, and everyone's entitled to their feeling, but we haven't seen a single incident where anyone was harassed or anyone was threatened or anyone was attacked. On the South Oval, and the entire thing was streamed online for the entire duration of the 6 hours. And you could see the videos. These students who were protesting were in a circle, singing, praying, sometimes chanting. They did not even use amplifiers for their, to make, you know, any loud noise. And there were counter-protesters, about, you know, a handful of them, who were standing there. No one even looked back at them. No one even talked to them. No one even bothered them. And we haven't had any of those incidents at Ohio State or any really any other university. We, you know, there wasn't any of this, you know, scale of anyone harassing anyone or anyone bothering anyone. So if they feel unsafe because someone has a message that is against what they believe, then that's a different subject. But if they're feeling unsafe because someone is harassing them, then what evidence could we see? Because we haven't seen any of this evidence.
Yeah, I will say not here, not at Ohio State, but in UCLA, there was a pro-Israel demonstration next to a pro-Palestine demonstration, and there were barriers between them. And it's not quite clear who crossed first, but they crossed, and there were some violent altercations. And that's really unfortunate that it ended up like that.
It's definitely unfortunate. And if you look at almost every single organization that organizes any protest across the country, and I'm talking more about Columbus and Ohio, the first guideline that the organizers give to their protesters is do not engage with any opposition, because they do not want any of this confrontation, any of this engagement. And I have witnessed in multiple events on Ohio State and in the city of Columbus where counter-protesters come and try to instigate the protesters. They try and come to start those issues. And we've pointed it out multiple times to the police. Sometimes they addressed it and they made sure that they keep them away from protesters and keep them separate. And sometimes the police, unfortunately, failed to do that. And we saw that in front of the State House once in Columbus when they allowed a counter-protester to jump in the middle of the entire crowd and start shouting at them anti-Muslim anti-Arab and anti-Palestinian things, which really angered a lot of the protesters. But luckily, we were able to keep everyone on the same message and not be, you know, sidetrack and go after things that we don't really want. We always say, do not engage with counter-protesters for this main reason. We have a single message, and all the students keep on repeating it. You know, we're out because those students are out because they're against the genocide, against what's happening in Palestine, against the occupation, and that's the message. And that's what everyone should stay on. And you will always find single incidents here or there that obviously people don't like and don't accept. I don't accept that, and I'm sure most organizers don't accept that.
That was Mazen Razul. Thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you.
And thank you to Ralph Young, a history professor at Temple University. His new book, American Patriots, A Short History of Dissent, is out now. Thank you so much, Professor Young.
Oh, thank you. And it was a pleasure joining you.
And that'll do it for this hour of All Sides on 89.7 NPR News.